Well, good morning. We are continuing with our series of lessons going through the Gospel of Luke, stopping at each meal that Jesus has along the way. We know that meals became something that were really important in the early church, and not only in the early church, really throughout the whole Bible. Meals are an important time of remembering God's blessings. They're an important time of community and fellowship. They're an important time of recounting the great acts of God throughout history and giving thanks and appreciation to Him. And they are an important part of Israelite ritual and Christian practice. We just had the Lord's Supper, which is a small communal meal that we share with one another in memory and in honor of the most important events and the most important facts that the world has ever seen. And so when Jesus wanted us to remember Him and His death and resurrection, He gave us a meal. Why? Because the meal matters. And the meal is something that we do in imitation of Jesus, because Jesus often had meals. Last week, we talked about a meal where Jesus went to Levi's house, who was a tax collector, and some of the controversies that arose there. Well, he's about to have another meal, only it's going to be a very different setting. But again, controversy will arise. This meal is going to be in Luke chapter 7, verses 37 verse 36 through 50, if you want to turn your Bibles there. And at the end of the day, when you read through this story and you read through what happens at this meal, I think there is a challenge that every one of us could walk away with, and it is to love much. Love much. Jesus is going to use the unlikeliest example as a demonstration to a Pharisee as to the proper way to love. And so we'll see how this happens. But it begins in Luke chapter 7 and verse 36 with an invitation to a Pharisee's house. It says, in verse 36, there was a Pharisee who was requesting him to dine with him. And Jesus entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. So, the setting is a Pharisee's house. This is the exact opposite of the setting of the first meal. So the first meal, he's at a tax collector's house, full of sinners and tax collectors, and the Pharisees are on the outside judging and not too impressed. For this meal, things are reversed, and he's actually at a Pharisee's house. And where the controversy comes from is one of those outsiders makes their way in. And so the setting is a Pharisee's house, and I think it's interesting that He was known and criticized for eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners. Yet he also would eat with Pharisees. The meal matters, and Jesus wasn't really exclusive as to who he would eat with. He would eat with the tax collector, but he would also eat with the Pharisee. Because Jesus, and I genuinely believe this, we can end up thinking, well, he liked these types of people and he didn't like the Pharisees. I think Jesus gave was open to anybody. I think Jesus would give a shot and give an opportunity to anyone to come to know him, even including Pharisees. So he goes to this Pharisee's house, and he reclines with him at the table. So that is actually an important description of what he's doing at the table. He is reclining at the table. When you think of sitting around a table eating with people, you probably envision something like I do, like the picture that I just had up there, a table with a bench that you sit on or chairs that you sit on around it. Or you might think of that famous painting of the Last Supper where they're all sitting on these chairs. That's not really what reclining at the table was. The table would be much lower, and as people gathered around the table, they would be basically laying down with their feet behind them, and they would be able to eat at the table, and they'd kind of be on their side, and they would be to where one person, you see this in the Gospel of John, where there's a conversation taking place around the table, and as the beloved disciple turns his head to talk to Jesus, his head is in the chest of Jesus, because that's kind of the angle that they would lay around the table. So it's a different setting, but it's an important one to know for this story, because Jesus' feet, as he's laying at the table, are accessible. Someone doesn't have to climb under a table to get to them, so that's an important little detail. But he's at a Pharisee's house, and then all of a sudden, a sinful woman enters. Now, when I say a sinful woman, I don't mean a woman who has struggled with sin a time or two in her life. I mean a woman who is a sinner, who is defined by her sinfulness, and everyone knows her as a sinner. This is a woman who's not just a person who sins, but the city knows her as a sinful woman. Whether she is a prostitute or whatever she has done, she's publicly known as a sinner. And not only that, she's seen as dirty because of it. People want nothing to do with this woman, and she also enters the Pharisee's house. What's interesting, if you look at verse 36, it says, "Now one of the Pharisees was requesting Jesus to dine with him." We don't see that same thing said about this woman. We don't see a request for her to come into the house. Now, a lot of the houses, they were pretty open, and people would wander in and out, and that type of thing would happen during banquets and during meals. But I don't think anyone expected or wanted this woman to show up. But she does show up. And she doesn't show up because the Pharisee welcomed her or wanted her there. She showed up because Jesus was there. Now, another assumption that we have to make, I think, in order for this story to make sense to us, is that Jesus has already had an interaction with this woman. There are a few details in here that I think make sense if Jesus has already met her and already perhaps healed her or at least forgiven her, because we see that come up as the story unfolds. But this woman comes in verse 37. It says, "And there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that Jesus was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume, and standing before him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and kept wiping them with the hair of her head, and kissing his feet, and anointing them with the perfume." So what I've written is that she humbly honors Jesus. She's crying in his very presence, and she's pouring out expensive perfume on his feet, and she's wiping them with her hair, and she's kissing. And all of these are demonstrations of affection and humility and love, but they're also odd. These are not what people ordinarily would do when you saw somebody. None of these are like following a social custom or anything like that. A woman who is a known sinner, so you immediately kind of, you know, put your hands up and give her a dirty look when she walks in, enters a place where she's not invited and starts acting in a way that's very, very strange, breaking social custom. And it's the type of thing where if you already expect a person to act kind of wild and crazy, they're just going to confirm all of the things that you believe about them. So while I say she humbly honors Jesus, I think the other people there would not word it that way. They would say, this crazy woman came in and acted crazy. And they would want to distance themselves from her because of that. They would think she's ruining the party. She's being awkward. She's being uncomfortable. She's making things weird. And it would be one of those things. Maybe you go and you tell stories about this odd transaction that happened at a dinner party where you were. And yet, that's not how Jesus responds to it. As a matter of fact, she comes in, she acts this way, and she offends the people who were there. The Pharisee is appalled by this action of hers. In verse 39, it says, "When the Pharisee who had invited Jesus saw this, he said to himself, 'If this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner.'" A couple important things here. One is I think the Pharisee may have invited Jesus to his house out of genuine curiosity. If you read the stories leading up to this point, you get this idea that there are these split responses and reactions to Jesus. Jesus enters a city called Nain, and the first thing he does there is he heals he brings back to life a widow's son who had died. And because of that, news about him spread all over the place. And word about him was spreading, and so much so that John the Baptist hears about it, and he sends some of his disciples to ask, "Are you the expected one?" And Jesus gives him an answer. But then he begins to talk about how no matter what answer he gives, though, there seems to be factions with the way that people respond. And some people are going to condemn and critique him no matter what. John the Baptist came not eating and not drinking, and they say he has a demon. Jesus came eating and drinking, and they say he's a glutton and a drunk. And it's like no matter what they do, they're going to say the wrong things about them. But what you'll see is that people are taking different approaches to thinking about Jesus, and it's causing factions and splits and disagreements and divisions. So, like, for example, Luke chapter 7 and verse 29 says, when all of the people and the tax collectors heard this, they acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves, not having been baptized by John. And so even just there, you see like different groups forming. And I think this Pharisee, Simon by name, is open to trying to investigate who Jesus is. He's heard about miracles, he's heard the crowds, he's heard the hubbub, the word about him is spreading, and I think he invites Jesus over to find out some things about him. But what happens instead is this woman comes in and kind of steals the show, and that gives him his answer, right? His answer is right here. Okay, this guy's not a prophet. There's no way. If he were really like a prophet or a righteous person, he would kick her off of his feet and say, leave me alone, I'm having dinner with someone important here. He wouldn't sit there and allow this grotesque woman to keep touching him. The idea of touch is something I think we even understand this as well. There are certain people who you would rather hug than other people. People who you know, or people you are close to, people who are clean, and people who are maybe, like you, you don't think anything gross about them, people who morally are like you. I think unfamiliarity with a person, hygienic differences, and even moral differences, like certain sins that you know this person, would make a certain person more grotesque to you, or you would want to keep your distance from that person more. We don't really talk a lot in terms of clean and unclean, but I do think we have some of those same types of concepts that can appear in our culture and among ourselves as well, where a person who does this, I don't really want anything to do with that person. I certainly don't want that person touching me. I certainly don't want that person kissing me. And yet this woman who would repulse the Pharisee is being welcomed by Jesus there at this table at the Pharisee's house. And so the whole thing is odd. And he says, if this man was a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is. And he's actually right about that. Jesus would know. Where he's wrong is in what he thinks the response should be. He thinks the response of a prophet should be to kick the sinner away, whereas Jesus responds to her with love and forgiveness. Jesus has a very different response. And it goes back to that same thing that we talked about last week at the table where he was with the tax collectors and the sinners. And they thought, well, he should never be eating there. Doesn't he know who these people are? And Jesus says, it's not those who were well who need a physician, but it's those who are sick. Like, you've misunderstood the mission of Jesus if you think he's only interested in nice dinner parties with fancy people. Jesus is about getting real and getting godly with even the most vile people you could imagine. And so the Pharisee understands who the woman is. He's trying to see if Jesus is a prophet, and he understands what a prophet should know, but he's completely wrong about the true response in love to a person who's in sin. And so after saying this, or thinking this, verse 40, Jesus answers and says, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he said, say it, teacher. And from here we get the main contents of this, of this event leads to an opportunity to teach. And so Jesus begins by teaching a short parable. I want you to listen to it. This is verses 43 and 42. Here's Jesus' parable. A money lender had two debtors, one who owed 500 denarii. That's about a day's work is a denarii. So 500 is going to be what, like a year and a half or so of labor. If you work for a year and a half, you'll be able to repay this. He says, but the other one, 50. So what? That's like 50 days. So it's like a month and a half or so. And so he says, one owes a year and a half work. If you include Sabbaths, it gets even longer. The other one about, a month and a half to 2 months work. But they were both unable to repay in verse 42. And he graciously forgave them both. That's the parable. All right, so here's the question. Which of them will love him more? Which is going to be more grateful and more loving to the one who forgave them? Well, the answer is fairly obvious, I think. Verse 43, Simon answered and said, I suppose the one who whom he'd forgiven more. And Jesus said, you have judged correctly. All right, so that makes sense. If you owe someone $20 and they say, don't worry about it, that means a lot, and you're thankful and you're appreciative. You say, thank you very much. If you owe someone $1,000 and you can't pay it, and they say, don't worry about it. I love you. This is taken care of. That is a much bigger weight off your shoulders. That is, the more you're forgiven, the more grateful and appreciative and loving you're going to be. One of the problems, however, with it is in this parable, it's easy to see there's like paperwork and receipts. Who owes more? When it comes to human sinfulness, there's not really like a paper trail that you could calculate it all up and say this person is this much in debt and this person is this much in debt. In fact, a lot of times, the way you view your debt is simply how you view yourself and whether or not you think you're a good person or not, or whether you think that you've done good things or bad things. And a lot of times, how you feel about your debt forgiveness is just entirely subjective based on yourself. And what we so often have a tendency to do is if we see someone do something bad, we define them by that bad thing that they did. All right, that person who committed that sin, well, that's because they're a rotten person who commits sins. When I commit a sin, I was having an off day. You know, it's like, I'm a good person. That wasn't really me. That was a mistake that I made, but it's not who I really am. And we often have ways of trying to justify our own sins and our own failures as a deviation from what we normally are, whereas we can look at someone else and define them entirely by their sin. And the less we know the person, the easier it is to do that. The closer a relationship you have with someone, generally the more benefit of the doubt you're willing to give them if you like that person. But if you hear of a stranger who did something horrible, you just think, well, that's a horrible person. If there's someone you already are predisposed to not like and they do something bad, then all of a sudden that's all they are. And I think that's what's happened with this woman and probably what's happened with Simon. Simon sees this woman and all she is a sinner. All she is vile and disgusting. Whereas he, I'm sure he knows he's sinned before, but his sins, they're not as public, they're not as gross, he has explanations for them, they're not really who he is. He's a Pharisee, he's a good guy. And all of a sudden he can define and explain away his sins to where he doesn't owe that much. Whereas this woman owes so much. But if you have that mindset, then even if you're forgiven, and you think, yeah, but, I mean, God hasn't forgiven me very much. You know, all of a sudden, it's not going to motivate a tremendous amount of love for God or appreciation or thanksgiving. Because you're going to think, I pretty much did it on my own because I'm a good person. And so Jesus offers the parable, and the answer is obvious. The one who's been forgiven the most is going to be the most grateful. But what that means in terms of our relationship with God is the better understanding you have of your own failures and sinfulness, the more you'll love God. But if you walk through life always justifying yourself, condemning other people, thinking that you're better than others, then all of a sudden you can be forgiven by God and it not even mean that much to you because you don't really see yourself in an honest and true light. I think the more honest we are with ourselves and the more time we spend slowing down and reflecting upon our motivations in life, upon how often we're truly selfish, upon whether we genuinely care about others the way that we say that we do or know that we should, the way that we compare to Jesus. You know, I think that's one of the biggest issues is we compare ourselves to ourselves or to others around us. And as long as I have a good number of people who my sins are a little bit cleaner and less public than theirs, then I'm above them. And as long as I'm above people, then I feel pretty good about that cell and I can pat myself on the back because I'm beating other people in this righteousness competition. But when you compare yourself to the holiness of a pure, transcendent, sinless God, then you begin to realize I am nothing in comparison to that. When we compare ourselves to one another, then we can have our little competitions, but these little differences mean nothing in comparison to God. And so when you think of your debt, don't always think in terms of how little I owe, or how clean my sins are, or how compared to these other people, I'm way better than them. When you think of your sin, think of who you truly are in comparison to Jesus Christ. Read through the Sermon on the Mount every once in a while. It's a bit eye-opening. Compare that to who you are. And as you do that, I think you'll come to appreciate the debt a little bit more. And the more you appreciate the debt, it's not intended for you to then walk around thinking, oh, I'm horrible, I'm in debt. It's intended for you to go around thinking, there's a God who truly loves me even in my sin and with my debt. And this God not only loves me, but he acts out of love to forgive me, to the extent, by the way, that he would give his only son to die for me because he loved me so much. The only proper response to that is gratitude and love. And so Jesus offers this parable, and yet then he brings up these two different responses that people have to Jesus. And again, I think these responses are rooted in how you view yourself. This woman, she views herself as a sinner who could do nothing for herself save give thanks and praise to Jesus as the one who has forgiven her. And so when she comes to Jesus, yes, she breaks all the social customs. She doesn't act appropriately like the way you're supposed to act at a dinner party. She comes in weeping and rubbing his feet with her tears and hair and kissing them. And like, it's an odd scene. And Jesus notices that all the Pharisees notice this odd scene. Certainly Simon does, right? But, you know, Simon didn't actually act appropriately either. Luke has withheld this information until now for the big reveal. We come to find out that they both broke social custom. This woman acted kind of crazy, but what did Simon do? He acted far superior to Jesus. When you get to verse 44, it says, turning toward the woman, Jesus said to Simon, do you see this woman? It's actually an important question to ask. Sometimes we can know about sinners or think about sinners without ever actually stopping to look at another person and remember that they matter. But he says, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but she, since the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with perfume. So there are social norms. When someone enters into your house, you provide some water for their feet to wash. You give them a kiss on the cheek. You give some oil for your head. Like, these are ways of showing someone that they matter to you. And the Pharisee, Simon, did not do that for Jesus. He was there to investigate Jesus, not to honor Jesus, not even to welcome him as a guest on par with everybody else. He broke social custom just like she did, only he sees her social custom break as something that's vile and disgusting, but his, well, it's an appropriate one because, you know, he's a Pharisee. It's his house. He can do what he wants to if someone enters into it. And all of a sudden, he's able to, they both break social custom, but she does it in a way that gets her judged, and he does it in a way that seemingly makes him think that he's better than Jesus. And so, as everyone sits around looking at this woman and how crazy she is and how she's acting erratically and how she's uncontrollable and how this sinful woman is bringing her oddness and weirdness into this room to ruin our table, Jesus says, how about I offer you a different interpretation? Instead of thinking of this as a crazy woman who's acting crazy, how about you think about this as a woman who is overcome by love? And this is the best way that she knows how to demonstrate it. This is a woman who has been forgiven much. And so you know what you're seeing right now? You're seeing this like uncontrollable outpouring of love. Something you did not offer. Something you did not present. But she has. You can look at verse 47. And Jesus says, for this reason I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. And so that goes back to the parable where if you don't think you have much debt to be forgiven, you don't respond with that much gratitude, love, and thanksgiving. But this woman recognizes. And so she's actually in a healthier place than the Pharisee is. Even though she's the one who's known and defined by her sinfulness, she recognizes it. And so she's not self-righteous. She's honest with herself and is able to grow closer to God because of that. And so they both break such social custom. Some people could interpret her actions as just craziness and sinfulness, but Jesus interprets them in the best light possible. Her actions are a sign of love, of a person who recognizes her debt has been forgiven by God. What about you, Simon? What about us in here? How grateful are we for the forgiveness that we have in Christ? How grateful are we for the love that God has demonstrated for us on the cross? Do we slip into the trap of thinking that we deserve it? I don't think we'd say that. I really don't. I don't think we'd ever say like, yeah, I deserve God's grace and his forgiveness and all of that. But I think we can inadvertently fall into the trap the more that we look at the world around us and elevate ourselves over the other sinners. When we look at the news and we see those people who are the polar opposites of us when it comes to moral reflection, when it comes to the relationship and response to God, and we look at them and we think, ugh. I'm not like that. I'm so thankful. Jesus is actually going to remind us about this type of thing relatively frequently in the Gospel of Luke. He'll remind us of a Pharisee and a tax collector who go and they pray. And the Pharisee's prayer is, I am so thankful that I'm not like this guy, the rotten sinner. And the tax collector's prayer is, God, be merciful to me. And God is. I think you have all these messages are converging as you see each of these meals unfold. But the main idea for this one is don't have such a high opinion of yourself that you don't recognize the grace of God that was given to you, because that will harm the amount of love that you are supposed to have for God. And so in verse 48, as we bring this to a close, Jesus says to her, your sins are forgiven. Those who were reclining at the table with him began to say to themselves, who is this man who even forgives sins? By the way, that's a question that was asked earlier in Luke as well. And Jesus says to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. It was her faith that led her to break the social customs, to go into the house, to enter in where Jesus was. And he says, that's the act that has saved you. What will your faith lead you to do? As we bring our lesson to a close, here's the challenge. I want you to look for the value and the image of God in every person that you see. This Pharisee was trying to determine the value of Jesus. He probably saw the value in his friends, and he saw no value at all in this woman. And yet Jesus saw value in every one of them. Let's try to open up our eyes to see, even in the wretched woman who comes into the dinner party, the value and the goodness of the God who loved her and created her. Let's try to see the value that God has created within each and every one of us. And to recognize that no matter how sinful you are, there is a God who loves you. And you have an invitation right now. If you want to receive his grace and forgiveness, you can. You can have your debt canceled out immediately and in full. You can name Christ as Lord of your life. Have your sins washed away forevermore in baptism, naming Jesus the Lord of your life and loving him and living a life of love from this point forward. If you can help you do that, you can talk to one of our elders in the library in the back, or come sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.